Well, have you been blessed already this morning in hearing from Psalm 103, in hearing about care that our minds go where they ought? Appreciated that help. This morning we're going to be basing this topic again on a phrase from our topical passage in 1 Kings 3. This time we're going to be looking at the phrase that helped Solomon to explain why he made the request that he did. He wanted to be able to discern. Yesterday morning we considered the desire and the need for an understanding heart, which we saw as basically meaning a hearing personality. Solomon prayed for that, so that he would be able to discern between good and bad. In other words, the two are closely linked. The one is the means to the other. We cannot make good discernments if we've only listened with one ear or gotten half the picture or don't understand the terms. So this, now we're going to look at the result of understanding hearts. Discerning means separating, putting what one has found to be this apart from what one has found to be that. Those of us who have the gifts of all five senses are equipped with amazing discernment apparatus. Your eyes can discern between slight differences in hues, can't they? Can you see the difference in color? Not a lot, but most of you probably can do that. This one's maybe a little harder. Is there still difference? It's supposed to be. Your ears can discern between fractions of a tone in pitch difference. Versus, and even slighter differences we can detect. The fingers can discern between slightly different amounts of pressure or temperature. The nose can separate the smell of one flower from another many times, although I just smelled a flower a day or two ago and was trying to link up what that smelled like, and I thought it smelled like a rose. But it wasn't a rose. Now, if I were to smell them blindly, I'm not sure that I would have been able to discern. Of course, not all roses even smell like, but sometimes at least we can do that discernment of smell. Tongues of trained tasters can distinguish subtle differences in coffees or wines. We make those subtle sensory discernments every day, probably. If only all discernments would come as naturally as these physical ones. In the text verse, Solomon clearly mentioned that what he wanted to be able to separate was not orange hexagons or flowers, but good from bad. And any caring leader in a home, a church, school setting, wherever, would want to be able to do that. Indeed, God has commissioned us to do that. But I don't think that ever before in the world's history has it been so difficult to make that discernment. And I'm fairly certain that never before has the devil felt so desperate to make time count for his deceptive work. He knows he has a limited time and the pressure is on him to work ruin while he can. And the Church of God today is feeling his wrath in persecutions in some parts of the world, in deceptions in our part of the world, in manifold toys, and it's going to only increase. So we have before us this morning a subject of supreme timeliness. But God's people have always faced the need for discernment, even though ours may be more acute. We remember the story of Joshua and the Gibeonites. And they ask, well, how do we know you're not from among us? So they realized there might have been some sorting to do, but they still failed that time. And Solomon, later in this very chapter, was already mentioned earlier in the week, had to discern, is it this woman that's the mother or that woman that's the mother? And that time he found wisdom's way. The early church, maybe a half century after the time of Christ and for the next number of centuries, had Gnosticism and or Arianism to deal with, and they had to discern. They had doctrinal issues that weren't so specifically clear in the Scripture, but they had to put things together carefully and discern. And a remnant did. Centuries and centuries later, the Waldenses needed to decide when they met with the Reformed theology. Are we going to keep our radical obedience, or are we going to take these reformers' word for this? Well, they failed that test. And over has that happened, that a why comes to the people of God. A why shape, a why question maybe, but a why shape I'm thinking of. And Robert Frost's famous poem about the road not taken really describes that situation artfully. And in that case, to him, the two ways seemed about equally good. I'm going to read that poem, even though many of you probably know about it. Two roads diverged in a wood, in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one way as far as I could to where it met in the undergrowth, then took the other. As just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy, and wanted or lacked wear, though, as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves, no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, let's say it together, and that has made all the difference. Well, I think, though, that there's a difference between Robert Frost's choosing between two woods roads and the Christians choosing or discerning of ways. Of course, we know that merely choosing the interstate or another road is never as important as choosing between right and wrong that Solomon wanted to be able to do. But Robert Frost's roads are symbolic of choices leading to outcomes, and not just about paths in a woods. But the big difference between what Robert Frost was writing about and what we're going to talk about this morning is that in this poem there's not a hint that I noticed of any guidance other than his own judgment. He stood and looked. They both had leaves on. They both were worn about the same. And so he just, you know, sort of a tit-tat-toe approach, and I'll take this. It's lacking wear, so I'll take the less used one. But we can be thankful that we have the wisdom that's from above to help us when we come to a why in the woods. And so our topic this morning I would like to use to refresh us in our thinking about Christian discernment and what the helps are that we have at our disposal when we need to discern. First of all, I'd like to think about the controlling purposes of Christian discernment. What should be our mindset? What should be back of our decision making? And I don't have much to say on this other than it's mostly one point. I've broken it into two different things, but they're very alike. But the first thing, the first controlling purpose, the major controlling purpose is that when we make choice, when we make separation, we want to be choosing what pleases God, not merely exercising preference. And that sounds simple. That sounds basic. But it's life-shaking in its reality. We live in a world that is disregarding principles, absolutes. Everything's relative. It's all me-centered. And everything is openly and proudly exerting its right to choose what works for me. I just saw a woman in my one workplace the other day wearing a shirt, and on the front it said, "I love me." Nauseating. People wear their philosophies on their shirt fronts, put them on their bumper stickers, saturate their advertisements with them, and they think it's just all right to have me for the guiding principle. And so it's not so simple to say, well, we're going to make our choices based on what pleases God. We have it about as hard as it can be to get that done. We are so drenched in our country with democratic ideals and the American dream that often even we do not realize that some of the parameters of life, some of the things that we think outline our doings, are not Christian, they're just Western or American. I'll give you one example. Are you and I entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? No. That is Jeffersonian democracy. That is not biblicism. We are entitled to serve our Lord. And then when we have done that which is our duty to do. But there's not a word in there about entitlement to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. I once saw a billboard down, I think it was in the Fayetteville, North Carolina area, close to a military base. And they had a billboard up advertising, it may have been one branch of the military, but I forget which. And it played on those very words from the Declaration of Independence. It was promoting the military, and it said, "Life, liberty, and the pursuit of those who threaten it." That's what the military is all about. So when we think we're entitled to live the good life of America, eventually that leads us to thinking that we're entitled to revenge against those who threaten it. Or we're entitled to buck up against whatever threatens it. And of course, that is unchristian. And so the viewpoint that led us to it is also unchristian. That's an example of how hard it can be for us to discern. We are saturated. We have long lived in a society that blends Christianity and democracy. And it's our calling to know where the one starts and the other one stops. When have I last done something for the sake of truth in my life so that I would know the difference between right and wrong, such as something so drastic as fasting? Did I ever do it? When have I last chosen specifically to do something with my family with simpler tools instead of the technologically advanced ones, simply for the good that it would do us? When have I forgone some purchase or entertainment so that I could for sure do it the way I know God would be pleased with, not just hope He would accept it? That's what we're thinking about. Pleasing God. It directs our discernment. It has to. Not the American dream. The cure for keeping this controlling purpose starkly in front of us is immersion in the Word and in church history. We have a brother in our community that probably many of you have heard his name, James Lowry. He's a Martyr's Mirror scholar. He's written material related to the Martyr's Mirror, and he's working on something right now related to the Martyr's Mirror. And I heard, I don't know if I heard him say or if I heard someone quote that he quote him, to the extent of something to the extent that I, after I get my the Bible and Martyr's Mirror read, I really don't have time for a lot of other reading. I don't think that's quite a right quote, but it was sort of that idea. Well, I used to do a lot more news reading than I do now, and I miss it. But I'm not sure if I ever will go back to as much as I used to do. We have to find the principles in church history and in the Word for keeping the controlling purpose of discernment what it ought to be. That I have to please God. The teachings of Christ, the teachings of the apostles. I do consider the Martyr's Mirror to be one of the four most important books in the Christian's world. We need to read about the brave and the insightful stands that those men and women and young women and young men took down through history that kept them apart from the apostatizers. Is it any secret that the church in our country is at grave danger from apostasy? We must always think about that whatever we choose. Whether it's related to purchases of toys for our children or what we dress in or what we drive or the occupations or the whatever, it has to please our great God, not just my preference. And then secondly, if you can call this a separate point, that it needs to be a controlling purpose for discernment, sometimes it might be sort of nebulous or cloudy in our mind. Well, what would please God? So we could break it off this way and say, well, we want to choose what will help other people and myself to get to heaven. I don't want anything more than that. Do you? I want to make sure that when I'm the one that's the funeral's being held for, that I'm where I want to be. And that's where I want my children to go. Sometimes pleasing God might seem to be somewhat hard to know. Is it this or is it that? But I don't think we usually will have too much trouble deciding, well, will this really fit with heaven or will it not? Will it help me get there? Or is there just too much danger about it? Now, with those controlling purposes discussed, I'd like to think for the remainder of the time what some things are in our lives working with children that require careful discernment. And I think I have about five. So we're going to start with the one that I have first, establishing reasons for children's misbehavior is something that requires Christian discernment. We could say that behind all misbehavior is the devil. Behind all misbehavior is the Adamic nature. And when I say that this requires discernment, I do not mean that we need to meticulously analyze each situation from a modern psychological standpoint, which tells us to, above all, not injure anything about the child's self-esteem. I don't mean that. But as we deal with more and more learning disabilities in our churches, as we encounter needs in children that have suffered from prenatal drug exposure, in the complexity of end time pollutions of food and so on, we need to be aware that children will not always be doing what they're doing for what seems like the obvious reason. They will not always respond like models to the rod of correction. We maybe think that we know that to be the biblical method and the Bible is true, but I tried it and it didn't work. I tried it again and it didn't work. I tried it again and it didn't work. And sometimes there are reasons for it's not working that really require some Christian discernment. They often are, but not always, in light of some of the things I mentioned, they will not always be acting for rebellious reasons when they say what they say or do what they do. So we need to pray. We need great amounts of patience. We need to evaluate the responses they make when we give them tender reassurances and when we punish them. When we spend more time with them instead of hurrying off to another meeting, did it seem to make them more comfortable, more responsive to our words? We'll need to do some study of special needs when children do not respond to normal training methods. That requires some very special discernment. Secondly, we will need Christian discernment to determine the method of punishing misbehavior. All children require discipline and punishment. But we all know, I hope, that the same infraction by one child requires perhaps only a mild punishment to make as great of an impression on him as for another child will require a more severe punishment to have the same amount of impression. And further, sometimes some children will show penitence quickly and readily. Others maybe have been impressed by the punishment but really don't display penitence as readily. And some with special needs may not display penitence at all or might even be going through a frantic reaction after the disciplinary action. We need to strive to make our punishments relative to the offense as much as possible. If it has involved words, then the punishment may need to be related to something about better words. We need to try to make some type of mental connection if we can. We need to make our punishments calibrated to the degree of wrongdoing. A spanking isn't necessary for every infraction. It wouldn't maybe be even the method of choice for some infractions. It needs to be consistent from one time to another of wrongdoing. And we overlook, we have our minds on other things or didn't hear or know, and that all happens to all parents, but that needs to be our goal, to be consistent. And we need to target the wrongdoing, not the personhood of the child. That all enters into getting the right method of punishment. And I know sometimes another teacher and I have, in discussing something that potentially was going to require spanking, we tried to decide, is that what we should do this time? Or should we talk to the parents Or should we do this or this? And, you know, we're tempted, at least I am, tempted to put off the spanking, and go to something that's a little less invasive or a little less drastic, but that all requires discernment. And we're glad when others can help us sometimes to make that discernment, especially when we're dealing with other people's children. But the method of punishing misbehavior is an area that's going to take Christian discernment. Another thing that requires Christian discernment that we face in the classroom is how to best relate to conflict or disagreement between the teacher's ideas and the parent's ideas, and the teacher's standards and the parent's standards, the teacher's commands and the parent's commands. Now, I am both. I'm a teacher and a parent. So I'm on both sides of the fence, and I know how irksome it can be, if you'll allow me to use that term, to relate to a teacher's requirement for my child that I, in quotes, know is not for the best. I know. I think I know. And I also know how irksome it can be for a parent to send a note to school about something that is intended to protect his child when I'm not sure that his child has been doing all he could. And I know sometimes that a given home has a particular weakness, at least I perceive it to be that way, and I feel as if I could tell the home something or other that would benefit their child's health or learning ability. For example, I know a family that has long sent children to the school where I teach, and that family, or at least the father of the family, has the outlook that reading is a waste of time. But we, and I don't think he'd be too bashful about letting that be known, but we teachers see that his children would benefit greatly if they'd only be given time to read. And he's materially well off. They could have time to read. It's not as if he needs to employ his children every minute to survive. He's well off. But he sort of keeps them under the hammer with the work. Now, it takes Christian discernment to know how to be a teaching teacher. And a teacher that encourages learning and reading and exploration, and not sour them toward their respect for their father, or, you know, all that. Another thing that requires discernment related to this conflict or disagreement between teacher and parent is, I've taught long enough that sometimes I am teaching children of my former students, and I remember some things about some of the parents' childhood. I do have a bad memory, or I would remember more. But that outlines the kinds of struggles we face sometimes. So if the child's doing this and it sort of makes me remember of something 25 years ago or whatever, then I know what the cause is, right? We think we do. We think we know why other people do what they do. We think we know what other people ought to know. They think they know what we ought to know. We need discernment, and parents need discernment, so that when we get together at meetings, that we speak what will help each other instead of aggravate and separate. We need discernment for what we ought to say and when we ought to say it, and or even if we ought to say. Another area that relates to school life that requires Christian discernment is with whom to discuss difficulties that come up. Who should I talk to this about? I need to unload to someone. I guess it was probably before I taught my first school year that the board chairman pointed out that at school we're sort of like a family. And just like we don't go out in society and broadcast family secrets, that's the way we ought to do it at school, you know, that we deal with confidentiality. And I think that is very important. So sometimes we discuss difficulties with nobody, at least till we get calmer. Sometimes maybe just in prayer to God. Other times, depending on your school setting, the school may be structured so that it's intended that you discuss difficulties first with the principal. And he may give you advice then that would be just the thing you need, or he may advise you then to go back to the parents and discuss it with them. The parents should not be the last one on our list. They should come before co-teachers. They should come before the whole faculty. The parents are not what we do when we are just about ready to pull hair. They're the ones that sent the child. They are the ones that spend the rest of the day with the child. And so my belief is that difficulties that you cannot personally come up with some things to try, or maybe you and the principal together working together, should be next referred to the parents. Maybe even the very first persons. Whom to discuss difficulties with? Don't use the difficulties as grist for a discussion mill. Just don't just throw this stuff out as chatter to spend time with anyone. What else takes Christian discernment? Well, it takes discernment to know what to spend time on, since there's never enough. Now, for some of you that are rather new in teaching, maybe you're sure that you should spend time on some subject you still don't know very well enough to explain without a textbook's help. And if you are a young sister teacher, maybe you're sure that you should spend time on a very nice bulletin board or two. And what is it that takes our time? That takes discernment, but we need to have a commitment to all of our callings guiding us in our discernment. Commitment to our calling, if we're a husband, to have some time for the work, the talk, the favors for our wives. We need to have time to be committed as a father, time for our children, to have time to do things with them, time to talk to them, time to listen to them read their reading story orally or whatever. There will be time needed for checking papers. There will be time needed for background reading and enrichment. There will be time needed for maybe improving a test or worksheet that's just not quite working the way you want it to. All that and more needs our time. And some days, the most important thing might be one of these on the list, and other days, another one might be. And it takes discernment to know. We can't just lock into a routine and always give our most and best time to one type of thing. The next one I have is maybe a little more of a nitty-gritty one. It's not so important, but it does take Christian discernment, and that is how to grade subjective material. See, yesterday was it one of the days we had a topic on handling research reports, and the instructor encouraged us not to just pull a grade out of the air. And I heartily support that, but what do you do? What do you look at? I remember a teacher saying that she didn't think you ought to give an art grade lower than C, I think it was. Well, she had a good rationale for that. And maybe no more consequential than art is for many students. It may be a neither here nor there issue. But maybe they write a poem. Maybe they make something in a woodworking class, or it's a penmanship paper or an essay. How can you grade it so that they will feel rewarded, but you're not being unfair to those who did much, much better by giving these people a B when really it's more objectively a D? Or when should you just comment instead of assigning a grade? That requires discernment, and it makes a difference in how our teaching is received. Related maybe to that a little bit would be another thing that requires discernment, and that is what level of work to be satisfied with. Recently, at one of the recent CMTI meetings, a teacher brought a term to my attention that I don't think I had ever heard before, and that was a student's sustainable best. You might talk about, now I want you to do your best on this. Well, you know, what that might mean to a very sensitive, conscientious person is labored, slow, penmanship-style writing and methodical checking of punctuation, and they could spend a far too great amount of time on something. And that is not sustainable. They can't do that day in and day out and function in the class as they should and in life. So what we want to be satisfied with is what this teacher was calling a student's sustainable best. It's his best taking into account the amount of time he has available, the abilities he has. He's not just obviously taking shortcuts and slopping through it. He's putting some care into it. And true, he could have written it more neatly, but that would have taken a lot more time. And so his sustainable best is, I think, a good thing to make discernment about. And then sometimes we need to decide when to change the level that we're requiring, and or if we should. That all requires discernment. The last one I have as far as areas that require Christian discernment is the matter of when to accept students' suggestions and requests. This year at our school, this past year at our school, we had a group of upper grade students that I think sort of felt that they deserved recognition almost on the same grounds as the faculty. Or they were just a little bit presumptuous. Without asking permission, they would maybe just sort of run ahead and get something going or assume it's going to be this way when no one exactly had said. Now, so if the students are counting on this being this way and they've already talked among themselves and they are already doing this, and you come to realize that they have a plan going and no one ever talked to me about it. Now, how should I handle that? How can they be put in the place of a subject without being unduly rebuked? When to accept the students' explanations of why it wasn't possible to be finished an assignment? Do you accept their reason? Sometimes we do. Sometimes we believe them and go on, and that's it. Other times, if it's happened repeatedly, or if we have reason to doubt a child's truthfulness, we may need the discernment of saying, well, I don't think that's the real reason. Maybe there are times when some students seem to be full of special requests. Could we eat outside today? Could we do this? Could we do that? But then they may be the same people that aren't fulfilling the regular things very well. And you sort of have the feeling that, well, you should do your required and regular things first before you feel free to ask me for extras. And should we just say it that way? What do we do? Those things take discernment. And we have help. When we stand at a Y, we don't look down one way and say, well, get me some dice. I'll throw the dice and see which way to go. I don't know. There are some helps. Our discernment is an improvement over merely looking down one way as far as we can to where it bends out of our sight. And that's not to say that I'm always going to be certain that my choice is what it should be when I make it, because behavioral issues are so complex and people can be so unpredictable and human insight isn't divine. But God does want to help us. And so I have a few things that I'd like to point out. Number one, He has given us the company of saints. Visit a lot with your brethren and sisters. Recently we had a Sunday afternoon visitor in our home. And he's a brother that I wouldn't call a sage by any means. He joined our churches from another background. But he's been with us for over 20 years. And as we visited, his different background and way of thinking brought out an idea to me, an idea or so that I was refreshed or encouraged by. I need what God has given him to help me be discerning. And those helps abound among our brethren. We need to visit with them. The company of saints comes to us sometimes through a periodical or a book. Read what your fellow brethren and sisters are writing. And fellow teachers are part of the company of saints. They can tell you things they've tried. Even fairly inexperienced teachers may bring something from their parental homes or backgrounds, little tidbits that are new to you. We won't all agree or use the same method, but if you hear several ideas that you like, well, you can make a choice from them. So the company of saints helps us in our choosing, in our discerning. The second benefit God has given us is the benefit of time. Nobody can force you to make a fast decision, and clarity of issues frequently increases as we take time to remember and check and consult. God has given us the help of time. He hasn't said that as soon as you approach the why, you must start bearing left or bearing right. It's all right to stand there a while and think, pray. He's also given us the voice of history. In our schools, we keep faculty meeting minutes on file, and we'll have them in the file by year, so we can go back 10, 15 years, whatever, and look among the records to see, has this been discussed before? And some of the minutes that we consider to be important enough, we put over into our faculty handbook, and of course it's indexed, and then we can quickly find, do we already have a policy made on this? That helps us in our discernment. Church and institutional history books can help us to avoid wrong emphases. For instance, is debating a healthy teaching tool for upper graders? I did it once. I'm not sure if I'll do it again or not. I might. Does pantomime have a solid foundation? How close am I getting in my activities that are to break the routine? How close am I getting to the field of drama that helped to take EMC downhill? So we need discernment, and the voice of history can help us. The fourth help I have is the spirit of love and the personal touch. We want to stay far away from the impersonal approach that society takes when they delve into their institutionalization. When people are identified by a number or simply called by their last names, when they're shuttled off to a special office to be counseled, or when they need to apply for an appointment to speak to somebody in authority instead of just approaching him in the hall, and so on, then the spirit of love and personal touch and loving our brother as ourselves has been either abandoned or at least muted. We need to keep the personal touch alive. And I'll tell you, it's been a help to me to, when I feel a little irked about a student right at my side who has a need and I don't really feel like doing anything nice, it's been a help to me to think about if that was my child standing there. Because I love my children. And the parents love their children. And sometimes if I feel like giving sort of a short reply to a person, it helps me know that I shouldn't when I think about if the teacher would be giving that to my boy. So we need to see our dear ones in those that we minister to. And we must see them as coming from families and having personal needs and being weak and human and needing to have gotten out of bed like we did this morning. We need to keep school rules, and we need to keep school regimen and schedule, but we must remember that rules were made for man and not man for rules. They must not be allowed to displace loving human hearts. Another thing that can help us with that personal touch is to ask how I would have felt as a student in this case. It has been a help to me, a rebuke to me, to be a student in a class as a teacher. I mean, to go to a teacher's instruction course and be the student and have the teacher act, let's say, mortified that no more than this has the assignment done and that kind of thing. And you get the feeling of what it feels like to be treated as a student by a teacher. Well, so how would we feel if the teacher were looking at me? That can help make the way clear. Now, the last one I want you to take carefully, the last help I have here, is the input of professionals. Sometimes people will say the Bible has all the answers for life. And that is not a false statement if we understand it correctly. But I would like to remind you that the Bible, even though it is primarily a spiritual guidebook, it does include bits here and there related to physical remedies and emotional remedies. So it's not as if God cares nothing about those things. And sometimes the Bible has all the answers in the form of guiding principles, but not necessarily specific, detailed answers. He didn't use men to write about realities of which that era knew nothing. Science's discoveries that we are aware of, many of them were not made by the era of the written word. And even though we do distrust many of the psychological practitioners in today's world, I've been encouraged to become aware that there are still some professionals around that respect Bible believers, even if they don't live out the Bible in their lives the way they should. And we need to sort carefully. It takes Christian discernment. But there are some helpful people around who have made studies of this or that that we may consult sometimes for help in areas that exceed our technical knowledge. We live by the Bible, but we're still very physical. And we're affected by our physically degenerating world. So sometimes we do need some specialist help. Solomon said, that I may discern. We're not Solomon's. But Solomon's God is still the same today, ready to help us. So I'd like to close with a poem, that I may discern. Father, here I am, the way I must discern. How should I proceed? Which way shall I turn? Should I say it now, or should I hold my peace? If I punish now, will problems just increase? Would tenderness and mercy be the needed touch? Father, I don't know. The issues are too much obscured by bends and lengths and shadows of the trails. Guide me and those I guide. Thy wisdom never fails.